another performance, isn't it? Thank you very much.
It's okay.
What a tour de force. I think everybody was completely absorbed into that performative piece. So I'm sure there are a lot of questions, but I've got so many.
Okay, great. Fire away.
Can you start to unpick a bit for me about the way that you construct the interweaving narratives? And I was thinking there's...
You mean in the talk itself, or...
Well, I think they're both, one and the same, in a sense,
yeah,
aren't they? Because they're the way that you structure the work. Of course, you start with the... We started, as the audience, with it's the six narratives piece.
That's right, yes. There's the piece done in... there were a few Italian ones at the beginning, which I think that era is over now. I think I finally... I actually don't speak Italian, really, hardly at all, so I've... yeah, it is really hard work making films in languages you don't speak at all. It's just your head in. But the very first one was to do with... I went to... You might know that there's a really fantastic residency in Rome, which you can all apply for, actually, called the British School at Rome, which has been going since about the turn of the 20th century. And I wanted to go there to do something in connection to this... there's a very famous Italian playwright or writer... He's one of their classic modernist early 20th century writers called Luigi Pirandello, and probably the play that he or the work he's most famous for, which often I have to explain what this is to anyone under the age of 35 because people don't know it anymore. It's interesting, which is Six Characters in Search of an Author, which I still think is an amazing premise. You know, and it premieres the theatre you're seeing there is the actual theatre that play premiered in 1921. That is Teatro Verdi, that is the oldest working theatre in Rome. It's currently closed, actually. And the premise of this play is that the audience come in and they sit down and they are watching what appears to be a kind of rehearsal for a naturalistic play. And kind of familiar, or maybe a rehearsal, so it's got this strange in-between quality to it. But then at a certain point, once you're settled into that and you think, I understand what this is, but at a certain point then, and how this is staged really depends on the director, you know, it varies a lot. Sometimes a crowd comes, a family-shaped crowd of people, and they walk sometimes down the aisle, right from the back of the theatre, from the entrance into the building, and walk onto the stage, or sometimes they come in a lift down from the back of the stage or the eaves. It really varies. But the idea is they come onto the stage. It's like a group of you coming here. But what is interesting is they insist that they are not actors and they're not people. They insist that they are fictional characters that an author somewhere else has invented and then kind of abandoned. And that they are furious that this has happened and they want their story to be told. And I still think that's amazing. I think it's astonishing. Kind of, you know, there's something about, well, what... I mean, we all know, of course, really as actors. Of course we do. Really, we know it's a bunch of actors. But the premise there... has a really interesting ambiguity about their presence and who they are and what they are. And there was something about that which was really interesting. But Luigi Pirandello, I mean, that when the premiere of that play, when it really did happen in 1921, because it played with broke the rules of naturalism so much, the audience at the time were just actually furious. And so what actually happened is they threw coins at Pirandello. He had to run away out of the backstage and escape. It was one of those stories, you know. And it later on became one of his best-known works, and he won a Nobel Prize for Literature in the mid-30s, and so it all worked out in the end. But for the last 10 years of his life, he had wanted to make this film, which was then... he was very, at that point, influenced by things like German expressionist filmmaking, so like The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and all these other things. And... but what the premise of this was, it was going to show this fictional version of the development of his own play, and he was maybe even going to be in it, but it was a sort of fictional version of him. And so it was fictionalising his whole creative process. And it showed this real Roman family and the effect this author has on their lives, which strangely really does mirror the real plot of his six characters. But except it shows the playwright, the author, in this really, I mean, he's a total bastard, you know. And but it's also because he cannot tell the difference between his imagination and how attracted he is to it and this real Roman family who are his inspiration. And he and so there's a real sort of exploration going on there about the ethics of the creative process. But what's amazing is it finishes with this conclusion with a fictionalised version of the premiere of his own actual play in 1921 in that theatre. So it's kind of, but he never got to make this. I think he was a really difficult person, and he tried really hard to get this made for 10 years. There were three. He only got as far as what's called a treatment, which in the process of making a film is the point before even a script is made. It's really a series of prose paragraphs which you're using in order to get a green light to get the funding made, and only got that far. And finally, I think Murnau was going to make it, apparently, but then he died in a car crash. And who did make, you know, the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and such like, so it didn't happen. And then finally, in about 1935, Joseph von Sternberg, who you might know, discovered Marlene Dietrich and such like, and a very famous Austrian theatre director called Max Reinhardt, had agreed that they would do it, but then Pirandello died. And this project of his then sort of disappeared because it was only found in maybe somewhere in the late 80s in the archives of Max Reinhardt, which at that point his archives were in Vienna. So this thing totally disappeared, and I had a text which was in Italian. I had to get it translated into English so as I could work with it in order to sort of do this work. And by sheer luck for me, because I didn't think I could get anywhere near a theatre like that, because it would be the equivalent for me of a really big West End theatre, it would cost a fortune, you'd never get near it. But given that we were in Italy, and this does happen in Italy, and it was under an occupation. I mean, that, all of the stories I'm telling you there, I mean, they're true, kind of true, question mark. And so it really was under a political occupation, so I got access. So that's how that all began.
It's an amazing theatre, isn't it?
It is, yeah, yeah.
And is the occupation in your piece of work?
Somewhat. I mean, it's implicit rather than explicit. There are signs up everywhere, yeah. And the kind of thump of the court. I mean, the idea of the six characters who I've implied are still somehow this living presence in the theatre. There is this very violent sort of thump of the boots, you know, them stomping on the ground all the way through. And so there is something about this kind of form of the Greek chorus, which it does start with a Greek chorus. And the form of a Greek chorus, classical dramatic form, is also that they are often this character of figures with masks who come out at the beginning of the tragedy or the play or whatever it is and explain the political and social importance of what you're about to see to the community, you know. And I try to keep some of that in there with the occupation. So there's this kind of link in there. But rather than really stated explicitly, it's implicit, you know. But they let me, yeah, they let me everywhere, and they didn't charge me a penny. It's fantastic.
So yeah. Did you form some sort of relationship with the occupation people? Because they must have been in the theatre.
Somewhat. They were there all the time. But they just let me,
They were busy doing their own
thing. And it helped I was a foreigner. It helped that, because I was sort of outside of their own political battles they were having. And they also said, Pirandello, we love Pirandello, and you know. And the actress you see there, Simona, she was connected to the occupation, although I did audition. To help me do the audition, and so they helped. They were kind of involved somewhat, but there is a poster which you see up. It's a big banner throughout, and that is a sort of political statement, you know, around the occupation as well. So it is about states a kind of thing about collectivity, and you know, so it was a wonderful occupation. I mean, I've got to say that it went on for 18 months. And they were really inventing a kind of new way of thinking about what the public, a public resource like a theatre should be like. Who is it for? And they, you know, they had all sorts of amazing people coming to work with them. You know, Peter Brook came, Zizek came. I mean, all sorts of people. You know, so it was kind of amazing. Whilst it, you know, it's a reimagining of what a public space should be like.
And what happened at the end of the occupation?
Oh, then the mayor changed and they got kicked out, and you know, the same old story eventually. But they were living in the theatre when I was there. So the story is true that they were living in the ease of the theatre while we were recording the extract you've seen. And so it is true that when we were, you know, it was 9 a.m. in the morning actually when we were kind of filming that, and there were people waking up saying, "Oh my God, my child has died," and they didn't know quite where things were, so it was amazing. They were sleeping in the theatre. Huh. Yeah, Yes, it, yeah, I mean, the soundtracks are quite worked. Yes, sorry. It is... I mean, so far up to this stage, I have largely done the soundtracks myself. I mean, the Pirandello work was edited by me, but mixed by somebody else, which was a great process to go through. And from here on in, I think I'm going to be working with other musicians and singers and so on some of the next works I'm doing. But I do work quite hard to make sure that there is a sort of sound world around the fictional story world of the piece itself. And partly because you are being asked as an audience member to, particularly, say with the Pirandello one particularly, but it happens with others too, to almost imagine not just the work that, not just what you're seeing, but you've been asked, the voice of the narrator is actually directing you to imagine another film that's not really quite present for you, because in a way, even with the Pirandello work, Pirandello's film, in a sense, still remains rather unmade, because you have the sites and locations of a lot of the places where the story should be taking place, and you have the wonderful voice of this that actor, Norman Mozartu, who's a kind of veteran actor, who worked with Tarkovsky. I was delighted. But he is telling you about this other film that you both see and don't see at the same time, you know. And the sound is a way of also helping generate that imaginative world. So it's a sort of way of helping that happen. And I worked up to now. I have a kind of quite a big sound library, and I do not play those musical instruments myself. I certainly can't go anywhere near that. But I do kind of get the licenses of the sound, the various sound elements. And I do, with that one, I do craft it right down to the single cello notes and everything. So it becomes this very, you know, I mean, the soundtrack was about 26, if you know the, you know, premiere or something, you know, like 26 kind of tracks long, you know, sort of organising every single note to create this world around it. So it's quite dense, you know. But I have to say, having said all that, I'm nearly at the limit of what I can do, so I will enjoy on the next one actually working with musicians who can play things, you know, and a composer who can create the music.
Will that be a true collaboration, or yeah, will it be under direction, or will you be... Where will that line be drawn between the two?
It's going to be interesting, because the next thing I've got, we've been talking about this already, but one of the next bigger things I'm doing, I've got coming up, is with the John Soane Museum, if anyone knows that, in London. And it's in October 2018, and it's to do with a kind of lost bedchamber of Mrs. Soane, Eliza Soane. And I'll be working with some of her letters and diaries, and I'm going to be writing, we were saying, a libretto, which I've never done in my life. But the way in which I'm having to work with this is that I can't film the room because it doesn't really exist. So I'm having to work with kind of 3D scanning and photogrammetry and digital archaeologists and such like. And this forces me to sort of approach the editing really, really differently. I've almost got to figure out where virtual cameras go before we render it out, because it costs such a lot of money to render it. So in a strange way, I'm going to have to sort of think... I've been saying I have to be like Hitchcock. I have to almost plan the whole thing out and how it looks somewhat, because we can't do endless footage because it's just too expensive and too time-consuming. And so figuring out how I'm going to work with a composer, you know, back and forth with that, it can't be, you know, in a way, I'm going to have to negotiate with them to work out, you know, do I give them the final kind of edited thing and they, as is traditional, you know, then they kind of slot in something around that, or can it be a little bit back and forth, which is what I'm used to, but the costs are very different and the workflow will be very different for me. So that's going to be a very different experience for me, but really interesting. And I have to say, when you do work with other experts, it's fantastic. It's so sexy. You know, working with somebody else who brings all their ingenuity and expertise to your work is really rewarding. It's fantastic.
How do you find them? How do you find the one that you can work with?
Oh, well, for the composer right now, I haven't a clue. I have to figure it out one step at a time. I have to figure it out. Lots of research, talking to people, and, you know, right now I've only got an intuitive sense of what I want at the moment. I have to begin to figure that out. And, you know, I knew that with, say, the Pirandello work and the others, I did have a sense of a sort of sound map. So it starts off being these very... heavy sounds, because I wanted this kind of sense of like a cauldron of the presence of these characters who are nearly coming through. And there's a certain point after the bit where you see the actress, so there's a sudden point where one of the characters suddenly emerges, that after that point, the rest of the sound landscape around it changes to these much more icy, glassy, thin, brittle sounds. So I kind of work out this sort of certain associations I want, and then I kind of try to find what I want. But, you know, I'm not a sound artist. I just I go on my own sense of the world I'm trying to create. Hi.
Hi. I was just wondering, do you always try to capture your artwork in film, or is it just a way of documenting it? And also, do you have, like, awareness that it could become that film of your art become?
Yes, yeah, sort of endless Russian dolls, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. Well, partly because I'm showing you a strip of film here, you know, video. There are other things I do. I mean, drawing is important to what I do, for instance. You've seen it with one of the works, but, you know, the drawings themselves get shown too. And one thing that you can't see there that I am do and I want to do more of is, you know, when you come to the situation of an exhibition, it's working with that spatially, for instance, and thinking about how the audience are brought through the unfolding experience of the exhibition as a form. And so that's a bit different. So sort of objects and objects and drawings and the images coming together is something I kind of want to craft and think about how you encounter the world, you know. And so, yes, there are drawings, there are scripts which exist. I mean, you know, the one of the train keepers, the first one you've seen of that. There's another form that exists in, which is in a book, which has the kind of script and also the sound cues and everything all written out as a work. So it's almost like the same work, but in another form.
How would you show that?
That's been printed. That's cool. That was actually originally made really for... the train thing was actually a commissioned public artwork of a funny or strange kind, you know, and to do with money from a public arts organisation in southern Italy. And that was to do with the passing of the railway workers' roles into, you know, so I was thinking, how on earth do I get into train workers in southern Italy? And, you know, and so that, I mean, but they knew that they didn't want to necessarily approach that as a classical exhibition. So the primary form that was made for was actually a book. But then, you know, I wanted to make this kind of, this kind of odd documentary, or whatever. Somebody called it a documentary recently, and I don't even know if that's what it is, but, you know. But there's a textual script-based, you know, base version of it. There was something else I wanted to do, which is the second thing you've seen of the act. It's actually an actress, Honora Gustamo, the last train keeper. And I said to them, you know, at the end, I did make the proposal to them, I want that to be a separate work where we do get one of those train keepers to write me a letter and it will go in the book. And for reasons even though I don't understand, that just didn't happen. So I then thought, well, I still really like the idea, so I'm just going to have to sort of fictionalise it because it didn't happen.
It was fiction.
So it was fiction.
It's a beautiful idea.
Yeah. But what I wanted to do, and we only did it to a certain degree, was what I wanted was that during the book launch, that then this actress would invade the press launch and insist that she reads the letter during the book launch. It's a very Pirandellian idea, actually, so it was like a character. So, and at times you can see the very last work that you've seen of, it's actually me, you know. It was actually the first version of that. It was actually in a gallery, a small artist-run gallery in London, whereby there's a projection on the wall, there's even some objects in a room, but the part of it that normally you'd have a voiceover narrative, that rather than that actually being, well, you were seeing it there played on the screen, and I try to find a form to reflect what I'd done in the gallery, but actually I stand there, like I've done with you here today a bit, and I narrate. You know, something you shouldn't be seeing, the narrator is physically there in front of the film, narrating the film. So it's almost like playing with the form of the film, so that certain parts of it are kind of held apart, and certain elements of it are physical, you know, objects or performance in front of you. So it kind of varies a lot. But I have to say, my background is as a painter, and I still think in those terms, oddly. And so the drawing and the back and forth relationship between drawing and everything else remains really important to me, actually.
The painting's beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Oh, the little black and white ones.
Yeah.
Yeah. And with that work,
just a lovely notion of the whole
But I
box.
Think of that work, you know, is that the box, because that train journey through Transylvania I talked about, I couldn't film that because it had already happened. So it was a way of making a film, and I think of that work as two films in one as well. Yeah. But that the film, the real film is in the box, is the 52 drawings. And I've sort of insisted to people, no, that's the film. the film is in the box, you know, or the 52 drawings, and it gets animated or played to you by, you know, lifting them up one at a time and showing them to you.
So is it shown as an object or only as a film?
Both. And so I have shown them a little. It's only been shown twice. Once in Holland and once in Southern England with the Arts and Children one. Whereby then, you know, you've got. But literally, then I have a kind of plinth with the box, and it's lit, and the box is closed.
No dirty fingerprints.
Or sometimes, I mean, I haven't done it yet where the drawings are all up, you know. But then, you know, so it kind of plays with this idea that the proposition is that the film is inside the box. It's another form of cinema by other means, of why can't that be a film too? Because it's the sort of cinema of the imagination.
Okay. You mentioned in part of the narrative that someone said that they didn't know what was real and what was fiction.
Oh, yeah.
And then you also mentioned the cinema of the mind, and you sort of get this really eerie and dreamlike feeling from the film. Can you just talk a little bit about that more, please?
The blurring the lines between, yeah, and that certainly interests me. Yeah, you're right to pick up on that. One of the last times I kind of worked with a painter in a very literal way, and it probably is telling in relationship to your question, was a collaboration I did with a painter called Andrew Grassi, who maybe I don't know whether you know or not, who wrote him a letter in about 2005, but it was from a fictional character. It's always these sad old men, but anyway, it was this, who then plead with him to make a painting, you know. And he described this room that he had lived in, and where there was this painting, he put it in his bedroom. And this room alluded to a room from his childhood and so on. It was really a way to kind of propose to Andrew a collaboration by coming from a fictional character. But the way we eventually... I then made an animation in relationship to Andrew's painting. And when we displayed this in the Format Festival, you might know, which is in Derby, it's mainly a photography festival, but at that point they were doing a... 2006 or something, they were doing a dialogue between photography and painting, and the way we tried to display it in this really tricky space, you know, with a terrible carpet and, you know, and everything, and we decided to make it into a kind of waiting room where the letter was shown, and then a kind of pretty standard projection of the animation itself, which I tried to process it so it looked a bit like a moving painting, like Andrew's paintings. And then the third room was just this reproduction of Andrew's painting, which are quite small anyway. And I remember saying at that point in time, what I was really interested in was in trying to break the edges of the narrative world of the painting. So is that it's a way of trying to extend the story world of Andrew's painting, but into the physical space of the gallery, you know. So it's then the installation and so on that we're trying to do as a way of doing that. And I guess there's something of that premise that's always been with me ever since. And when I was a painter, you know, I was a figurative painter at a point in... it sounds silly to sort of figurative and abstract now, but at various points in the... certainly when I was at art school in the 80s and being a figurative painter then, you had a very different... context held out to you of kind of School of London and things like this, and it was very insular. And I was always interested in storytelling and in narrative, but I wasn't interested in that being somehow really quaint, and, you know, I was interested in playing with this narrative world or whatever you were seeing, and sort of this being a portal to another place. And in a sense, what I think I've done is try to break the... It's a sort of form of expanded painting or narrative, you know, trying to break the edge of that world, so as that... What you said is the borderline between where is the inside of that world and where is the outside is kind of really played with. And I guess one of the reasons why I play with my own presence is, I mean, it is because I'm much cheaper than paying an actress. But it also is because then, of course, if I'm physically here sitting in front of you and I'm a real person, but if I also appear with fictional characters, and now it's a way of playing with the ambiguity and kind of ontology, you know, the sense of using this question of presence, making it ambiguous about what is present, just like this... six characters in search of an author. That's why that remains with me. It is really interesting. So what happens when you extend a narrative world into the everyday world and then back again in the other direction and kind of playing with that, you know? It's probably not surprising to know that I'm really interested in this interconnection between, painting, cinema, and I call it cinema rather than film, because it is to do with, you know, cinema even necessarily being those drawings in a box rather than a great big kind of crew of people making a film, you know, and theatre. And those, and the interconnections and spaces in between each of those worlds really interests me. And suppose so, yeah, so it's not surprising that playing with my floating presence or the ambiguity of objects and how what you provoke of what they are, their fictional and physical way, kind of as a way to play with that. It's a very long answer to your question, but yeah.
I think you played with that also in the, I was going to call it performance, it was a performance.
Yeah.
And there were times when you were in the relationship with the film clips that you showed, and also playful with them, because we only saw parts of them.
Yeah.
And then times when we were taken out of that,
yeah.
And times when the screen was blank and we inhabited the sound landscape, and you very much were the lit performer.
Yeah.
We had a very different start, blank screen, lighted narrator. And then this is sometimes almost a battle between your text and your spoken performance.
Particularly if I get the timing slightly wrong, as you may have noticed then again, because it's, you know, hairpin bend if I speed up or slow down at certain points. But
there's the whole thing all the time, you know, moving, a moving ground, really, of what where we were in this. This is a really banal question, really. I really want to know where you first found, where you first came across the six narratives.
Oh, do you know, it was many, 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 many years ago when somebody suggested it to me, when I was, I can tell you actually, it was, in my second year when I was a painting student at the Royal College of Art in 1988 or 9, one of my tutors, I had been trying to make these paintings of figures just standing in rooms, but trying to understand what their presence was. See, if things continue over many years, more than you might know. And one of my tutors at the time, Jim Mooney, if you know Jim, Jim Mooney said to me, oh, it reminds me of Pirandello's Six Characters in Search of an Author, and I had absolutely not a clue what he was talking about. I didn't know what this was. I was somewhere in my early 20s, but it stayed with me because he explained the premise to me a little bit, and I thought, that sounds odd. And it did take me still quite a while to get to it, because of course, as you probably know, your tutors give you great suggestions, but you don't always act on them immediately. But you know, it stayed with me, and I did go away and I read it many years later. And then I think I came across, in thinking about Rome and Pirandello and such like, I did think to myself, as you probably do, I'd love to go to the British School at Rome. How can I? But I didn't kind of know what to apply with. And then somewhere by accident, I came across it was a footnote to something, actually, that Pirandello had lived in Rome, because he's Sicilian, if any of you don't know. So I didn't assume he lived there, really. I didn't know where he lived. And then I thought, oh, he lived in Rome. And then I thought, oh, hang on, it premiered there. And then it just picked the conversation up. And then it was by chance finding out somewhere else about this unmade film of his. And so it kind of continued that. So in a sense, you know, the roots of that work and many of these things interconnect and go right back in all sorts of kind of ways that you're carrying these unresolved conflicts and things around with you for a long time.
And is that when the work's took on that playing with those different narratives? Was that a quite a seminal piece?
No, I think they one way or another been in different forms in the work all the time, you know. And for me, you know, the deciding to stop making, I mean, oil paintings and be a painter, that took me years. I mean, that took me quite a long time. And I was, throughout a lot of the 1990s, I was also helping, I was involved in kind of running an artist-run gallery. I think you had Sadie Murdoch here last week, and we were a group of people who helped run the Cubic Gallery in the 90s. But at that stage, I got to say, as a painter, you know, as I said, the context around figurative painting was very, the conversation was quite spare. You know, it was quite difficult to have to figure out. And I did need to do things like film theory and all sorts of other things as a way to understand what I was trying to work with rather than formal painting, you know. And I think over time, I started doing drawings, and then they became like, many, many of these banks of drawings of different kind of scenes and things in my studio, and they were all around me. And actually, it was somewhere around about the late 90s, another artist in Cuba, Angela de la Cruz, if any of you know her, is a friend of mine, came to my studio at that point, and she looked around the studio walls, and she actually got quite angry with me, and she said, oh, for Christ's sake, just go away and make a film. And I thought, really? And at that stage in the late 90s, I didn't know how to do it. I just didn't know how to do it.
And you never worked with sound.
No, no, no. But I didn't own a camera. I think I didn't even own a computer at that stage. And so I sort of didn't know what to do with that at all. But I thought, she's right. And I took a step back. I kind of left Cuba. And I deliberately took a step back to, for about 2 years, to kind of train myself how to kind of edit and deliberately made a choice not to exhibit whilst I just kind of found my feet. And the immediate question was, how do I get those drawings and bring them into time? Mm. And just to try to think about that, you know, and that took me a while to figure that out. And so that's why kind of animation has a basis in it, because it's so much more directly connected to the drawing, you know, one way or another. And, you know, so the thinking this through took a while to figure out, because I was trying to invent and find the form of the work. And I've also spent times, I've got to say, working in that journey. A lot of my other friends were going to doing the obvious career choices of, you know, they were trying to go and find connections in New York or Cologne or whatever. And I took myself off to Eastern Europe and, you know, and Soviet Union, but, you know, and Prague. And Prague was quite a big thing for me, you know. And I think it's partly because there are slightly different traditions there about the relationship, the very blurred, interesting, rich ground between performance and theatre, and a very physical approach to theatre as well, very visual, uses of staging and tableau and everything, which are still quite present in somewhere like Prague. And so I found a way to see another way, other ways of working outside of here, actually, you know.
Yeah, I think that's very true. Can you think of any particular examples of why that tradition is so different, or what is so different about that tradition? Because I sense it to be true.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking of concrete examples.
Why is that the case? I think I haven't got an easy answer to that, because I think there are certain things about... I mean, for a start, I think there are certain roots to theatre there and cinema which are not just based in the literary. You know, they are very visual and physical. You know, that's one thing. And, you know, there are, for instance, in Prague, there's what is called kind of blacklight theatre, which kind of mixes mime and, you know, those kind of things with staging and theatre and light and so on, and quite odd in hybrid forms of these things. And so I think there are certain... I think also there's what's interesting for me is that there were other kinds of modernisms, really, that got very covered over here, and the debate around... I felt kind of around painting, for instance, for me, and, you know, the camps of whether you were a very formal painter or figurative meant you were just completely literary, and I think I am quite literary, but, you know, literary in other ways. And so, you know, it felt very polarised in a sense here, where there was this rich sort of middle ground that was quite hybrid that was present in some of those other places. And, you know, I think also because of history in so-called Eastern Bloc countries, Prague and Hungary, and well, particularly Poland, but Prague for me is the one I know much better. What was interesting is that certain forms, you know, you've got to remember it's part of the Soviet Union, and certain forms of dissent and other imaginative, very seriously considering things like mime and children's stories and all sorts of things like this, became really invested in those forms. I mean, you know, things like Jean Svankmajer and all of that. Partly because it was really difficult to have a very open protest in other forms, so it kept these things very lively and moving. And there are, as I said, I think there is a sort of joined up, seamless interrelationship between all those different art forms that seem to be very separate here. You know,
yes, I think they are.
You know, and so there's a form of acting in theatre there which is very, it's a very physical and very visual. You know, and for instance, you know, you will find this maybe relevant, but you know, in my I mean, we've become very good friends, and we're going to work together again very soon, actually. Early on, I did a really good residency at the Centre for Contemporary Art there, which I'm not sure it still exists, but I met this artist in Prague called Michal Pakoček, who is now running a theatre. Just shows you, sort of, and he's gone through film and painting, and, you know, so he's a very good example of what I'm talking about. And friends were, people were saying to me, oh, Michal has just won this award. It's like the Czech version of the Turner Prize. And they tried to explain to me what this was. He moves these paintings from one side of the room to the other. I didn't really understand what they were talking about. But he said he would perform this for anyone who would ask him. And so I didn't really understand what this was. So I said, well, Michal, can I come? Can you show me what this is? And he said, of course. And we went to his studio, which was at that point in central Prague. to the top floor, and then I brought a friend, and he set us down at a table like this, and he had made, over 18 months, 27 oil paintings, and they were stacked up over in a corner of the room. And he played this music, which was actually from Hitchcock's Psycho. It was a little corny, but, you know, it was interesting. And then, in very precisely timed to the music, he then lifted up each of these paintings and put them on this pedestal that's covered with purple cloth. And then they showed this kind of story, I didn't know what this was, of a hospital corridor, and then it looked like a man being interviewed by a policeman who'd maybe done something, he didn't know what it was, and the man looked a little bit like Mikhail, you know. And at one point then you come out to a painting in the corridor, so it's a, these are all paintings, by the way, painting on the corridor, and at one point then the painting then crosses over to another image, which in a film would be what's called a cross dissolve, which maybe takes 2 seconds. That would be a long time. And he did this over 3 oil paintings, and he held them up. And I, as I was sitting looking at this, I thought, what the hell is this? And you can see this stayed with me. And I then I thought, this is like a really perverted form of animation or something. It's like he's performing the movement of the film strip moving through the gate of the film, but. So you can see my mum with the hands is quite connected to this in a way. And I kind of thought, I understand this territory. This is really interesting for me, you know. And Mikhail, for instance, is a very good example as somebody then who has gone on to make quite a few films there, artist films, and is now running a really good experimental theatre in Rome called Studio Horodny. And I'm actually going to work with him again soon again. He appeared in one film of mine called The Prompter of Krumlov, you know. And we're going to be working together. I'm going to be filming the creation of a fictional character with the film theatre. So it's just that these things are not questioned there. People move across those boundaries without even asking or thinking they're going to ask permission. They just do it.
That seems to be exactly what happens in your work.
Yeah.
I think that's a really nice story to end on, and a lovely exploration of actually how your practice operates. What a fantastic talk. Thank you very much, Anne-Marie. Thank you very much.
Thank you.